Welcome home. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We are Baltimore Positive, getting it out on the road this week. We have the Maryland Crab Cake Tour coming to you. It's all brought to you by our friends at the Maryland Lottery. I'll have Harlem Globetrotter scratch-offs to give away. I hear a little sweet Georgia Brown going as I get it. Wednesday, Gertrude's at the BMA. Got Dan Rogers in the 1966 show. Friday, we're at Costas in Dundalk. Alan and Luke are going to join me. We're going to do a lot of baseball chatter. And then on Tuesday, we're going to be at Missoni's in Perry Hall. A little bit of politics, a little bit of sports, a little bit of Baltimore, and certainly some springtime as we get into this. It is baseball season. I am previewing baseball all month long, as well as writing. I'm a man of letters at this point, and I'll be writing letters to all sorts of people, beginning with John Harbaugh this week, Jesse Minter, amongst others. But there will be the Craig Albernaz letter and the Katie Griggs letter and the Pete Alonso letter and the Gunnar Henderson letter because it's baseball season. I love having friends on. Eric Fisher has become a friend of mine over two decades. He once covered the Peter Angelos Masson sweepstakes in 2005 and 6 in Washington as a member of the Washington Times. Long career at Sports Business Journal, now is at Front Office Sports, and sticking to the front office in the business of sports. And but more than that, you're a baseball nerd like me, and you like baseball, and we talk about on the field, off the field, but you do a lot more than that. How are you? Happy spring training, World Baseball Classic, whatever you want to call it at this point.
Yeah.
But it is baseball season.
Yeah, it's great. You know, been a busy football season, was out at the Super Bowl, you know, came home. We got pounded with a foot and a half of snow, but it's melting fast. I can see the shoots of grass coming through, which means baseball's around the corner.
Well, you and I have done a lot of things about Masson and the television network. This is the first year that as a fan and a banished media member, some would say discriminated against, but I've managed to watch like five Orioles spring training games just in the first week and feel like I know more about the team than I used to in the past because you couldn't watch the games. And I know it was an archaic thing here. Give me your 50,000 feet because people can find us out on YouTube and see that we've talked dozens and dozens of times when Mr. Angelos was alive and when he passed, when Rubenstein took over. Like you and I, we're going to get at labor peace at the end of the year and all that. But give me your state of the Orioles and what you've seen from the outside, because it has really been a rocky patch of everything since these guys got here and they haven't even hit the labor discord yet.
Yeah, as we've discussed in prior appearances, I was pretty, you know, when the sale happened, I was hopeful that it would be a whole new era after all these decades and was pretty disappointed with what I had seen on and off the field initially. And, you know, you had a talented core that was really to kind of take the next level and with some, you know, additional resources and some forward thinking, I thought that all the pieces were there to do that. First couple of years, we hadn't seen that. I'm a little more encouraged by what I saw in the offseason. They went out and got Alonso, a little more aggressive, you know, maybe with some better health and better cohesion that maybe it'll be a little better. It's a brutal division, you know, because as we've discussed, Toronto is for real. But, you know, Baltimore should be a little better. Rays are under new ownership. Yankees are the Yankees. I'm a little more hopeful than I was a few months ago about the Orioles, but again, it's still very much a show me kind of thing that, okay, you know, what is the next step going to look like? So I just, still very guarded in my optimism.
Look, man, I've known you 20 years, and when they made the move with Masson and the Nationals came on, I was on the radio in Baltimore saying they should move to the National League. They'd have a better chance of winning. They could create a thing with the Phillies. They, you know, they'd be at, like there's a lot of things. Let the Nationals deal with the Yankees and the Red Sox and having to deal with that. Mr. Angelos wanted the gate that was associated at that time with the Red Sox and the Yankees playing three series a year, which felt like about 20 games a lot of years where they was built in. They didn't have to give anything away. They sold the stadium out. The Yankees would bring the Messinas and the whomever and the Jeters in, and the Red Sox would bring the Pedros and the Schillings and the Poppies in and all of that. But I think in this modern era, the fact that you would say, well, the division's stacked, they don't play the stacked way anymore, that this is a benefit. Not a lot is broken right for the Orioles this century, and including the new ownership from my eyes. But the one thing that they do have going for them in the old days, I would say, you don't want to see the Yankees, Blue Jays, and Red Sox, 21 times a year each. They don't have to do that anymore. And I think for that plus the fact that more teams get in the playoffs, plus the fact that 87, 88 wins can get, so all of that saying, and then once you get into the playoffs, it's a roll of the dice. It's times are better for them than they used to be, where you had to win 101 games in 1981 in the American League just to make the playoffs, right? Like, they have a chance for real, and I can sell it as such.
Yeah, and it is important to know you sort of hint at a correct thing, that we're in a balanced schedule now, where it's not the unbalanced schedule where it was those divisional foes so many more times, as the league overall tries to nationalize the sport, and now there's an opportunity for a Paul Skeens or an Ohtani or somebody like that to come through with some regularity through a place like Baltimore. And it's going to be even more like that once we get to some sense of realignment, which is probably coming down the pike in some matter of years. But right now, what I was kind of referring to is what the pathway is to get into the postseason. Because that would, this year, next year, that would be the what I would consider getting back into the tournament, that they were in for a couple of years there, and it looked like, again, they were on the upswing, and then we had this marked retreat. And so I think first step one for this team is getting back into the postseason. Getting back into the postseason means holding your own against the teams I just mentioned.
Eric Fisher's here. He covers baseball as well as all the sports in the business of sports at Front Office Sports. They were last place team last year. They lost a 500,000 fans in the first real year of ownership of the new group. Some lucky fans got a Rubenstein bobblehead out of this. The money spent on Alonso, I sign off on. The money not spent on big arm pitching after Corbin Burns last year kind of turned their money down, didn't want to play here, wanted to play in Arizona, blew his arm out. Getting Bradish back, having the Rodgers trade smell a lot better than it did at the All-Star break when Kyle Stowers had 30 home runs or whatever it was. And then where Rutschman is, Westberg, Holiday, injured, Couser. They're going to have Coby Mayo at third base for a minute here and try to figure out if they got a bat. The Tyler Ward thing for Grayson Rodriguez, who was going to be the next Jim Palmer, if not Storm Davis or Rocky Coppinger. I don't know, but there's been a lot of tumult here. Let's say since Angelos died, which we're only going back 24 months now,
For a
in
couple of
regard
years.
to, it is hard to believe, Angelos' departure, Elias, change of manager. In all of that, and now this sort of
And the Nationals
importing,
walk from Masson.
oh, yeah, for the business side for sure, but importing Pete Alonso. And to my way of thinking, and I've been at this a long time, they spent $19 million on a number four pitcher in on Valentine's Day. And I'm like, the Angelos group never did that. They maybe in 1997, David Wells, Jimmy Key, whatever, but like that was not a part of the modern vernacular, which is, and
This
let's
is
just go
part of why I
throw,
have a little bit of optimism.
throw $20 million because we need a little more pitching so we can make the playoffs. That was not something that was part of the vernacular here. So for that, I'm going to give them points.
Yeah, and as do I. And that's where this kind of guarded optimism comes from, that and Alonso, and just showing a little bit more of a pulse than we had 6, 12 months ago. And that, again, with better cohesion and better health among the existing core. I think this is way better than a last place team. Are they a juggernaut? Not necessarily, but I do think they're far better than what they showed last year.
All right, let's talk state of the game, and because we can do WBC, and you can blend that into me wanting to go to the Venezuela Dominican game in Miami, finding I was $300 to get in, but I can do Israel and the Netherlands or whatever for $7. But it there is a level of fervor in regard to the Olympics, and you can jump on that because you do the business of all of that as well, and the hockey teams, and Trump being so divisive that he divided the men's and women's gold medal winning hockey teams along gender and along politics. It's crazy, but and maybe he'll throw some toilet paper to Puerto Rico, and he bombed Venezuela and took the leader, and they're in the tournament. And Cuba, by the way, they're not letting some of the guys in, and these are the guys that played against the Orioles in 1999 that are part of the scouting and the coaching. Like, Even the World Baseball Classic and part of like how all of that blends into the politics of all of this and where the game is and where the game's headed into labor hell at the end of the year, because this is a really weird year for baseball all the way around because of the war drums that sit at the bottom of this that only people like you and me ever talk about. Like, it's not, people don't want to talk about it. We want to talk about who's starting on opening day and all of this stuff. But everywhere I go, they're like, this is really problematic for the sport right now.
Yeah, so there are a number of different threads in there. That's from the top line of the sport in and of itself, just like the state of baseball as a entertainment property. Attendance up, ratings up. We've got Ohtani, Judge, great collection of stars. That sort of very top line level, really good. The international stuff that you reference, also really good that this is becoming a more global game. And yes, there is a geopolitical undercurrent that obviously, Major League Baseball doesn't control, but this World Baseball Classic, this tournament's going to be a hit. It's going to do very well. You've got a number of stacked teams. Of course, the defending champion, Japan, but U.S. is bringing everybody with Judge and Witt and Skeens and Skubal and Bryce Harper, and they're emptying out the cupboard as well. And so I think that tournament's going to be really great as well. But as the season goes on, we're going to be increasingly worried about where the labor negotiations are. This is a labor year, as we like to say, because the current deal that was signed in early 22 expires on December 1st. We've got these very sort of existential questions as to whether there's going to be a salary cap, not a salary cap. And in the midst of all of that, we just had a change at the top with the MLB Players Association, where there's, some scandal surrounding the former executive director, Tony Clark. His number two, Bruce Meier, has been elevated. He's running the show. There's the same kind of philosophical bent within the organization, but how those labor negotiations unfold this summer, it's going to say a lot as to whether this momentum that I'm referencing continues into 27 and beyond.
Well, anybody that's listening to you and me at this point knows we are OGs about all of this, back to Messersmith and Lords of the Realm, and me being on the radio in the spring and summer of 1994 and beyond. I've been at this a long time. Back, I'm so old that I remember when Angelos bought the team and took the side of the players. And now we have these rich guys from New York that come in and they're Mr. Moneybags and Arrighetti and they're all into this. I've wondered aloud if they even know when they signed up 2 years ago that Rubinstein even really knows enough about baseball, because Peter didn't. Peter did not know at all what he was signing up for in regard to, I just want a team and be famous and own the Orioles and whatever. Rubinstein had the same thing, not really realizing how bloody the gloves can get in these fights. And there's always the battle drums. And look, I knew Mark Belanger back in the day, and I had Don Fear on, and I've had Marvin Miller on my show, and I've had Faye Vincent through all of these years of discussing all of this stuff. I've never had John Hellyer on, although I do want to. But for me, in discussing it, the modern part of this and how much money in the pie, to me, it feels very, very like Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve, like the original sin of they were all too greedy all along. The NFL owners figured this out. The NHL and NBA owners figured it out because they got labored into it. The baseball thing was such a war and such a divide that I don't know how you adjudicate the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Los Angeles Dodgers and the New York Yankees. I don't know how you find the middle. It'd be like finding Towson State to find the middle with Alabama or UCLA. I just don't know when there's different revenue streams how they're going to figure this out. But it's the same exact argument we had in 1994. It's just more money and a wider divide.
Yeah, there are a lot of generational echoes, to be sure. And I think a lot of this it comes from, my personal view is that the top of the funnel is not really the issue. They're going all out and maximizing what they can. I have much more issue with the bottom of the funnel, and this sort of speaks to what I, over the years in current ownership and prior ownership, what the Orioles could and should be, and other teams like the Orioles, Pirates and so on, could and should be. It's a matter of how you bring up that bottom and create a more equitable standpoint. and all these other leagues that you reference, you know, there are a lot of historical parallels there. There's sort of two buckets as to whether you sort of break the union, like hockey did most notably, or you make the grand bargain, like the NFL did in the early 90s, essentially swapping unrestricted free agency in exchange for the salary cap. To not have any lost games next year, I think you got to push this closer to the grand bargain. But what is the grand bargain that the players would accept when they're just still so hell no on anything that looks like a cap? I wonder if there's something there that you sort of make salary cap or free agency eligibility earlier, salary arbitration eligibility earlier, and try to make some kind of grand bargain. That's the task in front of Rob Manfred right now. But whether or not he can do that, that's what these next 6 months or so are going to tell us.
Well, local revenue is just so imbalanced and
But
further
if you nationalize
imbalanced.
it more, you could smooth out those differences and get more to an NFL model. Because somebody like Dallas or the New York Giants, they're nowhere near Jacksonville, but Jacksonville can be a playoff team because everything is kind of nationalized. And I think that's the direction the league would like to go to.
Well, I remember Curt Schilling sitting on a couch 30 years ago, talking to me about this as the angry player rep then, and Jimmy Poole and Mike Messina and all the guys of that era talking about the money and the fact that really this is an argument amongst the owners, not amongst the players. This is about rich owners and richer owners. And a guy like Angelos in my market, who swore up and down that if they got the revenue of Masson and siphoned off of that, that they could put a competitive baseball team here to compete with the Yankees and the Red Sox. And really, the money just went into his pockets. And that was the story then. It's what got me thrown out telling that story. It was true 20 years ago. It's true now. And I don't know how that will never be a part of how the players feel about, okay, where's the floor and who's in charge of the floor? And in every sport, there's a Mike Brown or there's a Donald Sterling or there's just somebody, Al Davis, somebody that just is going to participate differently. And in baseball, it's always been every 5 years we get together and reenact whatever the scrum's going to be, or the war, or the big battle is going to be. And it really does come down to owners being up and on the up and up about whether they're going to win or not, or whether they're trying to win, or whether they're trying to bilk taxes, take money, and just give a pap a wave while they make money and the players make money, and they don't really care about whether they win or not. Tanking. And the NBA is a great example of that.
Right. And this is what I'm saying about sort of having the bottom come up. They've got more work to do. And I think your point is well taken that there is definitely sort of a hawk and dove thing that's got to be resolved within the management side before we can really get anything done with the players. The other half of this is that if you're going to do anything like this system, you actually have to strike a full-on partnership. And yes, the league and the union have been able to get along and do things on a number of levels, and they co-own and operate the World Baseball Classic, for example. But to do a deal like this and the kind of scale that we're talking about, you really have to have an enhanced level of trust. And it's hard right now to get to that enhanced level of trust because, from the player's standpoint, they look at literally the last century plus of baseball history. And there is a long and documented history of owners screwing players out of compensation through a variety of means, whether it be the collusion in the late 80s or screwing players out of bonuses or what have you, that there's got to be a way to sort of push all that fully to the past and get to a new era where there is a different level of trust. And that's going to be really hard to do. But if something like that could be done, I think you do get a situation where the imbalance gets addressed, because that's the fundamental problem that we're talking about here, is that they're, you know, real and perceived. There are some imbalance issues that need to be addressed.
My guest is Eric Fisher. He's with Front Office Sports. So we like talking about the business of baseball. It's an important year to do that. And, you know, we talk enough about on the field and who's going to play and how many home runs Pete Alonso is going to hit, and how much Maryland Lottery is going to have to spend on home run riches. And we'll get into all that. But I knew the history of this incredibly well because I lived it in the early 90s on the radio when I had to explain it and there was no internet. So I, you know, read Lords of the Realm. I talked to players. I talked to management. I talked to lawyers. I tried to talk to smart people like you, you're a lawyer as well. Try to talk to people I know. To get educated about this, but I'm not current on this. And to me, it always felt like humans, George Steinbrenner, Peter Angelos, Bud Selig, who was an owner at heart and always was, and whatever the lawyers were, whether that was Marvin Miller in the beginning, or whether it was Don Fehr later, or whether it was Rob Manfred, coming in, or Peter Angelos and being good cop, bad cop when these negotiations would happen, whether it was Alan Trammell or Mark Belanger or Tony Clark, I guess in the modern era of all of this, who are the humans that are really involved in this above and beyond Rob Manfred and Meyer? But who, I have wondered aloud, and you can correct me on this, but Arrighetti and Rubenstein come into this. I have been led to believe that Arrighetti might actually have more money involved in the deal. He's certainly the younger guy, certainly the more baseball guy. But I look to him, and he has no public persona in Baltimore, neither does Rubenstein. They've owned the team for 2 years. They've made bobbleheads of themselves, but they've said nothing about anything, not even the $600 million that they've gotten to throw the media out of the press box and build $38,000 a piece season tickets. I wonder where they stand, because the players are all, I think, are going to get pissed off and line up behind Bryce Harper and Verlander and Scherzer and the angriest of the angry. We have the pitcher here this year, Bassett, who is a union guy, that the angry 30-something guys that all have $100 million in the bank already are going to be the ones getting the Gunnar Hendersons and the Adley Rutschmans sort of fired up about, hey, do this for Brooks, do this for, every Louis Aparicio, all the guys that never could get there. Steve Carlton couldn't
You
get
see, this
there.
is a really interesting point because in the 2002 negotiations, there actually was a divide between the union leadership and the rank and file, that the union staff and the executive committee were all against the last deal that the league put on the table, 0-8. Among the executive subcommittee of the union, rank and file actually approved this deal, and which is how we got it done. And there actually was a, because we have kind of a declining middle class in the sport, that there is a certainly a monetary and a philosophical divide
Yeah, how do
between.
you get guys that can't afford to get off the field? Same thing happens in football, that they
Right.
need to play to get paid. You're telling me not to go to work today? Come on, dude. That's
Right.
where scab lay, that's when all hell breaks loose, right?
Yeah, and so how the so yes, the owners absolutely do have a hawk and dove issue on their side. There's a little bit of one on the player side as well. That
There's
I think
plenty of strike pay. They have a battle chest. The
they do have a
players
battle
that are
chest.
ready to walk next April, they're not going to starve by walking, but it's hard to explain to a 25-year-old who's got $6.2 million on the deal, like, I don't want to take a month off and lose $1 million when you're that guy, right?
And you're also in literally at that stage in your competitive prime, and those mid to late 20 years when you're quite possibly going to put up the best numbers you will in your entire career.
Yeah, well, that's where the players have to stick together. And is Meyer the better? What do you make of the politics of the Tony Clark thing? That's crazy, right? All of it.
Well, I think there is a bunch of issues surrounding Tony that didn't really necessarily have a lot to do with the matters that we're talking about. There were some interpersonal, staff and family things. There was the whole bit with the licensing and the one team partners. The core operation of the union and these labor bargaining matters, that's really not kind of germane to what Tony's undoing was. As for Bruce, he's a hardcore labor lawyer. He's very much cut in the same cloth as Rob Manfred and and his crew are on the other side. And
Did you expect Clark to be the one to battle this, or all along was there some
yeah,
movement
Bruce
afoot that
was
we're going to
always
put
going
a
to be the
lawyer in
main.
front of it?
Though
Yeah.
they had an interest, they had a great sort of partnership, the two of them together, where again, Bruce is a hardcore labor lawyer. Tony brings the player perspective and has a whole series of relationships, on that level, that on the field level that Bruce obviously doesn't have. And I thought they complemented each other very well in that regard. So now Bruce is going to be sort of going at it alone and probably relying a little bit more on the eight guys in particular on the executive subcommittee. And the big name on that one, Tarek Skubal, who just won a massive historic arbitration,
So he will be the heavy for the young guys.
yes.
That's what I'm essentially asking you. Who
Yeah.
are going to be the headline makers once the manure hits the fan?
Yeah, and I would say particularly look at there are a bunch of other guys in Bassett's another great name that you mentioned because he's very active as well. But since Scoble just went through the war on this arbitration thing and got what I would consider a laughable offer in return. I mean, the guy's no worse than the second best pitcher in the league, and to come back with a $19 million offer, an arbitration from the team. I mean, it was just absurdly low. Now, whether 32 is the right number, that's obviously what the panel agreed upon, but I think we can all agree that 19 was too low. So he's just been through that war.
That's a
So
big win, by the way.
it's a huge win. And so, he's just personally had that experience in the battle, but he's also, again, a headline guy that, a lot of these, a lot of your superstars are not exactly necessarily your biggest union guys. You mentioned Belanger, great player. I don't want to slouch him, but, he's not Cal Brooks and Eddie, it's very rare when you
It's
have.
different when it's Bryce Harper getting in Manfred's face saying, get out of clubhouse.
Yeah, so although, that's a little bit of a different thing that I think it, that had less to do with, Harper's position with the union than his own temperament, because, he runs hot and Rob can run hot too. And I think, that boiled up, and I think they ultimately talked later and kind of smoothed it out, at least for the moment. But the point that I'm making is that in a lot of these instances, your frontline guys are not necessarily the ones foremost in the trenches on this stuff, but Scoble's going to be one of those guys.
Eric Fisher educating me. Thank you, by the way. That's really at the crux and the heart of bringing people like you on, is to say, teach me this a little bit. Now, teach me the other side, because I lived through Angelos here both times. When he saved Bud Selig 8 years after the strike, and he was on the player's side, then he was on Bud's side, and then in the end, he's always on Peter's side. So he's on Team Angelos. I don't know where these cats sit with Arrigetti and Rubenstein. I know they're billionaires. I know they put a lot of money up. I know Mr. Arrigetti especially expects a return on his investment. And things aren't selling so well here. They're a last place team. They bought a first baseman. There's no real enthusiasm here. The Ravens have the Lamar thing going on, and both teams have new
Coaches,
leaders, coaches, managers, whatever you would say. So it's a weird, squishy time for Baltimore sports in a general sense. But there's also the part where people bought into the new owners last year. I had friends that bought Birdland stuff and got really pissed off by the raising of the prices, the lowering of the value. Katie Griggs had told me she's going to sit with me. They didn't like. I just the city's tepid, lukewarm. You'll see. Yeah, you'll see when they start selling tickets in April that the stadium's more empty than it is full. They're doing a lot of bobbleheads. They're doing giveaways of Star Wars night and doing all that stuff. But the battle drums are coming, even if the team's good, right? If the team has a magnificent summer, that's not going to change labor. And I'm wondering where the Steinbrenners and the Reinsdorfs and all the names, the O'Malley, the people that used to run baseball, and names and venerable names, who are going to be Hawks and Doves? And a lot of these things are owned by consortiums now and this and that. Who are the humans around Rob Manfred? Who are the five Jerry Joneses and Bob Crafts and Mr. Biggs that are going to come in and put their foot down one way or another in regard to how ownership's going to deal with the players this time around? Because I do think it is a different era than the reserve clause. We've moved on from Curt Flood. It's a different era of people than even Don Fear and all the names I've given you. How will they get a deal done? I mean, at the end of the day, who's going to be reasonable at any point to get whatever a reasonable deal is done so that they're actually playing baseball this time next year instead of warring?
Yeah, and I think you're gonna have to, look for teams like, Boston, maybe the Cubs, sort of like your bigger market teams, but not necessarily at that Dodger level that could maybe sort of speak to both sides of the table a little bit, because you do have people like Colorado out there, and Dick Monfort, who are like hell bent for more existential change. And like, basically he's already on record saying that what's going on with him having to try to compete with the Dodgers is past the point of ludicrosity. So he's going to be on sort of one side.
By the way, Steve Bisciotti, when I used to drink beer with him before he threw me out 20 years ago, told me that he didn't buy a baseball team because he didn't think it was fair. He just said, basically, like, I just didn't want to buy into a sport where we would never have enough money. Like literally, that was fundamentally
This gets to what I'm
kept
saying
him
is
out.
that.
That's a billionaire who just didn't want in the game. Even though he loved baseball, he just like, nah, I'm not going to fight that. Now, Rubenstein, I don't know what he knew. These guys knew about this war that they're going to have, but and what side they're going to be on. I guess that's I'm trying to read the tea leaves and saying, what do the Baltimore Orioles want? What do the Washington Nationals want? And how are we going to get to a point where they can figure this out? Because all of our lifetime we've been arguing about this, and I don't know that we won't a year from now, but I'm trying to figure out like when the light's going to go on for all of them.
Yeah, and again, they're sort of chasing a moving target because, again, this whole bit that I'm talking about in terms of nationalizing the revenue, that really doesn't happen until after the 2028 season. That we're in this labor thing now, and the deal that they're going to make the first 2 years of whatever deal they do, or even if they just do a 2-year bridge deal, it's for a revenue situation that exists now, but is not the revenue situation that Rob Manfred and others want to create. And what they want to do is take their existing national TV rights, a bunch of additional games that normally would be on a regional sports network, but all these RSNs are dying, and take a bunch of that inventory and completely repackage it. And so a bunch more games and a situation like yours could show up on a different platform, whether it be Amazon, Netflix, what have you. Paramount, now that they're buying, Warner Brothers, the whole media landscape is changing. But the broader point that I'm making is that they're kind of chasing a moving target. And that sort of informs how all these owners think about this, because if you can shuffle the decks and nationalize the revenue a little bit more, that teams like an Orioles or a Pittsburgh or even a Colorado could feel a little bit more comfortable in their ability to compete because this whole situation's been smoothed out. But again, there's a lot of ifs and buts in there.
Well, that's why I think like Arrighetti and Rubenstein throwing money at Pete Alonso, throwing a little money at Bassett. I'll hear all of that. No one, including Katie Griggs and certainly Arrighetti and Rubenstein, will never speak to me or anybody like me, or probably not even you. So I don't even you get to talk to Manfred once or twice a year and ask him some questions, and he'll pick up the phone for you, maybe, and maybe Barry Bloom and a couple other guys I know who will talk to someone like him. And this is the question I keep asking. And this is what I would ask Katie Griggs if she and I ever had a real relationship, to sit and talk to her and say, all right, Katie, just between you and me, what's the plan? What's the plan? Not the plan to beat the union up, not the with the bullshit we're going to sell the fans about how much the tickets are. What's the inside plan? You bought the team, you paid $2 billion for the team. You think the city's going to do what? And the state's going to do what? And the land is going to do what? And you're going to battery what? And you're going to warehouse what? And you're going to have what? And where's the revenue stream for that? And then there's the media side that whenever I turn to you, and you're one of the smartest people I know, you, well, the revenue and the regional, and now they're reorganizing that a little bit. And then I ask you to explain it to me, and you don't really have the answer, and Rob doesn't really have the answer, and the cosmos doesn't have the answer, because they keep betting that I'm going to put Apple TV on Friday night and give Apple $6, and I ain't. And I was in Toronto for the second game of the year last year that wasn't on television anywhere in the city because it was a Friday night. It was Apple TV. And what bar would have Apple TV? And certainly I can't find that at Cooper's Pub or Costas Inn. The games aren't on, and they don't think about all that. They just think like everybody's going to be bending over backwards to buy all of these subscriptions. And then all of a sudden the game's not on, and you don't watch it. You don't care that you don't watch it. And you lose a 500,000 fans in your stadium the first year you bought the team, like last year. And then you snippet the Nationals here. So my question is always about my team, my market, my city, my franchise, all of that. I can't get any answers out of the new people. The new woman here only cares about the All-Star game in 2028 or 29 that they're going to get, and how they're going to revenueize that. And I don't know who these buyers are, but the television and the media part of this is I can't find anybody, and I know you write about it every day. Give me the strategy of what this looks like in 2029 once we beat the union up, we get the salary, like what do the Dodgers look like, and what do the Rays look like, and what do the Pirates look like in a perfect world if they could fix it? And then what does the where's the revenue coming from? What am I buying per month, per year, my subscription, and what am I getting for it? And I've not seen anything that even looks speculative. I've just seen a bunch of, we'll get to that when we get to that. And the regional sports thing's drying and it's a little different. And we're going to take it in-house, but I still haven't figured out how they're going to get the kind of revenue they need for the Colorado Rockies to keep up with the Los Angeles Dodgers, no matter what they do. And I've been chasing that tail for 40 years on the radio.
Yeah, and it's going to be hard because fundamentally, in any of these scenarios, what we're talking about is a situation where instead of getting revenue from people, whether or not they watch the game, which is the traditional cable model, is it's going to be much more direct one-to-one in terms of getting revenue from somebody who actually does consume the game. And that is a smaller, what they call a total addressable market.
And they're going to have to get more money from each of those people.
Right, and they're going to have to get more money from each of those people, but also they're going to have to find other ways to expand the total addressable market. And so this gets to things like the league doing more stuff on TikTok and doing more stuff internationally and trying to find new fans beyond people like me who are, you mean you are going to be there regardless. They got to start looking under, they're beginning to look under more rocks as well. But regardless of all of that, it's only going to be getting revenue from people who are consuming the games. It was a great situation that all sports had before that you're getting all this passive income. Those days are over. And so, the whole Magic 8-Ball has been shaken up. And, all of this, the entire rest of the decade, we're going to be in this transitory phase.
Yeah, they're almost like a hockey team. They almost have to figure it out at the local level. Eric Fisher's here. All right, so last thing, because I am Baltimore, what are you bullish about with baseball? And, on the Oriole
Well,
level,
I'm
I'm
bullish
bullish
about
about
the
the team's
star
better than
power.
last year here. And that's just for us. But I mean, just on baseball, give me something good.
Yeah, the thing I'm really bullish about is the talent of the players. We are watching a really great group of generational talent who are like locks for Cooperstown. And I'm talking about Judge and Ohtani and Paul Skenes and Tarek Skubal that I mentioned before. And you could rattle down all the other lists of stars, Yamamoto coming in and starring the way he did last year, and Vladdy doing what he's doing in Toronto. And you could name 20 of these guys. And obviously, it always kind of starts with Judge and Ohtani. But this talent base is just, and even the younger guys like Ellie De La Cruz, who are just getting started, that what gives me hope is that for a variety of reasons, we're getting a better athlete in the game. And I think some of it may be just, folks not wanting to play football or basketball or whatever for a variety of reasons. But the star players and the crop of guys that we have right now, they're just fantastic.
And you mean Gunnar Henderson and Adley Rutschman and
Yes. Oh,
something
yeah.
magic happens. Well, I mean, it is an embarrassment of riches in regard to talent in Baltimore and 1-1s and all of that. But it doesn't help you when Jackson Holliday and Westberg aren't out there to start the season. But, they can't start worse than they did last year, getting the manager fired on Preakness Day. So we're hoping for better things ahead. So is Eric Fisher, who covers the business of all sports. Tell me what you're doing in front office sports these days, Eric.
Yeah, we're growing like a weed. It's a great problem to have. And not really a problem that, we are a successful growing entity in sports media, and there's not a lot of us out there that, we've got our website, we've got multiple newsletters that we're doing. I'm still doing a lot on our flagship newsletter, The Memo, getting a little bit more into live events. We just had a massive space on Radio Row out at the Super Bowl. Largest space and just A-list guests all week long. We're just we're a true multimedia, multi-platform sports media company, and we're having a great time doing it.
Well, I tell you what, man, I appreciate you always and the insights you bring, and certainly more important than ever if you are a baseball fan. And I know it's thick, and I know people didn't want to hear about the mass and money and like all of that. That's a big part of the Orioles, though, right? Like that the Orioles broke up this mass and thing. Now it is more sing for your supper. Rubenstein believed this when he got into this. It really is go time for the Baltimore Orioles in a way that it has never been the whole time I've been on the radio here in the way that they were managed and operated, right?
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing. And just to sort of recap for your listeners, that we had 20 years of legal fights between the Nationals and the Orioles. They finally resolved this, you know, pretty much this time last year, that there was a legal settlement that, you know, resolved everything, and the swords were finally put down. After all these years, the Nationals ostensibly won and got the additional money that they had been fighting for all these years. And as part of that settlement, they had one final year under Masson's control, which was last year. So they served that year, they finished out, and now they're doing their own thing, and they're part of the in-house media model, the MLB media model, at least for the time being, where the league is producing and distributing the Nationals' local games, which then means that the Orioles, under Masson, they're a one-team operation. And so that's less games, fewer games, fewer, you know, less revenue, and they're going to have to figure it out. And what I am curious about is, what is the long-term viability of Masson? Does that network continue to exist? Do they try to merge with somebody else? Do they just shutter it and fold into MLB Media?
Well, they better figure something out, because there's not a lot of revenue coming to that. There are not a lot of baseball fans. There's not a lot of baseball fans that want to just reach and give money to them. And when the games go away, if the team's not very good, they'll cancel the this and the that. They'll have no subscribers and all. Like, Eric, dude, I love you, and I love talking about all of this, and I've been on the radio forever. I worry about all of it, because, like, I live here in the middle of it, and I know the way they've treated me, and I know the way they've treated Jim Palmer and others, and I thought this new group would be really raring to go to change things, and it has been a sleepy effort. Above and beyond Pete Alonso and a couple of this and a couple of that. I mean, they had their winter carnival blizzarded out. You know what I mean? Like, they just – they don't work hard here, and they never have. And it's really a weird thing watching them try to compete with the Yankees and the Red Sox when they think like the Durham Bulls.
Well, this gets back to what I was saying before, and you talk about, like, what is the plan? Like, I bring up the Cubs, and I know I've done this before. I'll do it again here on your show. The Cubs and the Astros, when those new owners, Jim Crane and Tom Ricketts, came in, they went to everything. They were going to the opening of a door. Every chamber of commerce, church suppers, you name it. You know, all the fan fest stuff. And it, like, this is our plan. This is what we want to do. And, oh, by the way, both of those, it took a number of years, and they were terrible for a while.
Yeah, these people haven't even asked us what to buy into yet. They haven't come and said, here's our plan. Are you buying it? Instead, it's, we're the Orioles. Buy it. Yeah,
well,
literally.
This is what I'm saying. They need to be practicing the retail politics that the Cubs and the Astros successfully did and got people to buy in. And, oh, by the way, they've both been a little wobbly since they won the World Series, although they're, you know, the Cubs went back to the postseason, but they've continued to draw well. Even when there was a little bit more blood in the water about their on-field performance, they never really sank super bad because there was a trust level there. And I think a trust level still exists. And you got a sense that both of those owners still want to win. And I just having, you know, we shouldn't having to be asking so hard for these answers in the case of the Orioles, because they should be out there telling anybody who will listen.
Yeah, I worry for all of it, just in a general sense. Even if they win this year, the labor thing may really hamstring them in the end. Because I don't, and this is the thing about guys like Rubenstein and Arrighetti. They're in control of everything because they're wealthy guys. Nobody controlling a labor situation in baseball. I've been around long enough to know nobody knows where that ends. Literally, right? That is a black hole.
Well, and also, again, the 2002 situation was really instructive, that, you know, it was kind of percolating for a little while, and we weren't sure which way it was going to go, and the management imposed the lockout, and it got really dark for a while, 99 days, and then, you know, January turned into February, and then it turned into March, and we weren't sure if we were going to get the season done, and it was right there at the end of March that they finally figured it out, and they were able to kind of rejigger the schedule a little bit, and they got in the full 162, but it was very dicey until the very end, and it was the whole situation I was describing before, where the union leadership and the rank and file were at kind of opposite ends on out of that. So those last 7-10 days, all over the map. And I could see a situation like this really coming through again this year, where, you know, everybody involved in that situation, don't make any Thanksgiving plans because their Thanksgiving is just trash at this point. And that whole late November period going up to the December 1st deadline, that's going to be one wave of this. And then going into
And
early
there's no
next.
off season, right? They would have no, they wouldn't sign, no players would
Right.
sign. There'd be
Yeah,
no
that would all
action,
be
right?
fro yeah, that would all be
So we'd have
frozen
the
down.
Homestead
Right. In
Homies
a lockout situation,
again.
all of
Right.
that would be frozen. But then there would be another wave in that February, March period where it would be very fluid yet again. And your point is well taken that we're gonna not know until we know. And this could break a lot of different ways because it gets into leverage and tolerance in a lot of respects.
And I keep asking, where do the Orioles stand in this? Where what is their ethos on all of this? And what would they like to see happen? Because I feel like we're the poor guys here. You know, I remember we were the rich guys when there was no team in DC and we had the, you know, the Cal Ripken and all that. Certainly, that's not the modern situation for the Baltimore Orioles playing at a 35-year-old Camden Yards. You know, like times have changed a little bit and revenues changed a little bit. And certainly the Washington Nationals and the Baltimore Ravens exist in a way that they didn't. I just worry about them. I love baseball. I want it to go well. Eric Fisher loves baseball too. He's at Front Office Sports. He covers the game as well as other things. But no one knows. No one knows the mess and laws better than you. I'm glad that part of it's over. I don't have to bother you about that anymore. That feel nice.
Yeah, and like I said, the structures are going to change a little bit, but both teams can now just do whatever they're going to do, which is kind of what we were always talking about way back in 2005. And a lot of what's happening now is undoing a 2005 business model, but conceptually it gets to what I think we, a lot of us said should have happened from the start. Let each team just do their thing and let the chips fall where they may. And now we're kind of getting to that point.
All right, something magic happens on March 26th. It's opening day. Luke and I will keep you abreast of all things breaking news between now and then, whether it's Lamar Jackson or Tyler Linderbaum or the tampering period. I could have done a whole hour on tampering period on the NFL with Eric Fisher. They do sort of rule the roost, although we like baseball around here. Always appreciate you, man. Fist bump to you. Get down here
Yep.
to Baltimore. Hey, Fadley's for a crab cake when you get down here now,
I
right? Pick
know.
a game.
Gotta do it.
Hey, man, we're taking Luke's niece to her first game. She's four, she'll be five in May, and it's Nelly night, and they're playing the Athletics franchise of Sacramento, Oakland via Vegas. So come on down, we'll get some crab cakes. I'm gonna go to some games this year. I'm excited about it.
The team, like I said, the team should be better.
Pete Alonso going to cost John Martin a lot of money at the Maryland Lottery. Home Run Riches is alive and well with our friends at the Maryland Lottery, and baseball is right around the corner, which gives me a chance to bother my old friends like Eric Fisher from Front Office Sports. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We never stop talking. Baltimore positive. Stay with us.